From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a description of the hardships of desert war from Soviet journalist Artyom Borovik. He covered the Soviet war in Afghanistan for Ogonyuk, the magazine that most reflected the new openness of the late 1980s in the Soviet Union. We also meet novelist Madison Smart Bell. His new novel, Dr. Sleep, is about a hypnotist who can put other people to sleep, but not himself. Book critic John Leonard reviews John le Carré's new spy novel, and rock historian Ed Ward looks back on the year 1981. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House says the Soviet Union is working on a diplomatic plan to resolve the Persian Gulf crisis. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Earlier today, President Bush received a surprise phone call from Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. The president said the Soviet leader was thinking innovatively about ways to convince Saddam Hussein to leave Kuwait. Since then, Mr. Bush has met twice today with the Soviet ambassador Alexander Besmertnik for more elaborate briefings on the Soviet effort. There are no details on the Soviet plan, and officials here caution not to put too much hope in what the Soviets are working on. Nevertheless, President Bush says he is confident that the U.S. and Soviet Union are committed to the same goal, getting Iraq out of Kuwait. "We remain in sync," says the president. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Iraqi President Saddam Hussein told a gathering of Muslim leaders today that Iraq would defeat the United States in an Islamic holy war. The conference approved a resolution urging Muslims throughout the world to attack American and Western interests if war breaks out in the Gulf. The religious leaders in Baghdad were denounced as non-Muslims at a rival conference which met at the same time in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. The Mecca meeting called on Iraqi soldiers to turn on their leaders, saying Saddam Hussein had strayed from Islamic teachings by invading a fellow Muslim country. 4 days before the United Nations deadline for Iraq to leave Kuwait, there was a report today that Iraq plans a new diplomatic initiative. The New York Times reported that Saddam would agree in principle to leave Kuwait in exchange for an international conference on the Palestinian problem. Jim Zeroli reports.
The Times said Saddam would make the offer on January 16th, one day after the UN's military force deadline, to show he won't be intimidated by the United States. The newspaper also said he would seek assurances that Iraq will not be attacked. The Times based its report on interviews with Arab diplomats it did not name. Egyptian and Saudi officials interviewed at the United Nations today said they knew nothing about the initiative, and the report was denied by Iraqi officials. One official said the only initiative planned by Iraq is the one announced August 12th. On that date, Saddam suggested that he might leave Kuwait in exchange for an Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
About 45,000 people marched today in Athens in an anti-government demonstration that ended in violence. The protest began last month when high school students staged demonstrations against the government's education budget. This week's massive protests were triggered when unknown attackers killed an activist high school teacher. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just under 3 points to close at 2,501.49. Advances and declines were even in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The U.S. may be on the verge of fighting a desert war. My guest, Artyom Borovik, is a journalist who covered the Soviet desert war in Afghanistan. The Soviets went in without understanding what fighting in the desert would be like, just as Americans went into Vietnam poorly prepared to fight a long jungle war. Borovik made his first trip to Afghanistan in 1980, the second year of the war. His last trip was in 1989 to watch the withdrawal of Soviet troops. Borovik spent time in combat with the troops. His first-hand accounts of the fighting were published in Ogonyuk, the first Soviet magazine to really reflect the new openness in the Soviet Union in the late 1980s. His report stayed away from ideology and focused on the pain, doubt, and disorientation of war. He's expanded on those accounts in his new book, The Hidden War. Borovik now hosts a TV show, which he describes as the Soviet version of 60 Minutes. He also reports for Nightline here in the U.S. I asked him if there were any lessons the Soviets learned about fighting a desert war that he thinks Americans should know.
The Soviet Union was preparing itself for a global war like the Third World War, and for a war in Europe, and thought of itself as great superpower, and we thought we will come in Afghanistan and win the war immediately in 2 or 3 days. We thought we'd need maximum 2 weeks to win the war and to support the regime, the Babrak Karmal regime there. But it turned out that we fought in Afghanistan for about 9 years, and this war was deadly and destructful not only for Afghanistan but for the Soviet Union. And sometimes it seems to me that this war is now has crossed the border with the army that was withdrawn from Afghanistan and now going on inside the Soviet Union, as national unrest, as crime, as chaos, economic chaos, and so on. We came to Afghanistan not really knowing what a war in the desert is like. We were not prepared for it. From the medical point of view, from the point of view of arms, from the point of view of ammunition. Well, for example, let's start from the boots that that soldiers have. When sand gets into these boots, in a couple of minutes, the leg is a mess, is a mixture of blood and meat. You cannot untie these boots all the time because it will make your unit weight you, and this is risky. It means that risky for the whole unit. So you keep on walking, and your legs start bleeding. Then you will find out in the Gulf that soldiers, American Rangers, will prefer fighting in sneakers, Adidas or Nike sneakers, because it's much easier to fight in it. You can take it off in 1 second and put it on. It doesn't take too long to untie it and to put it on. So Soviet Spetsnaz forces were fighting in Afghanistan in the desert in sneakers. This was a very funny and strange situation.
What helmets. Else did you learn about outfitting? Yeah.
Helmets are not good for the desert because in a helmet like your soldiers have and like a helmet like Soviet soldiers have, they look alike. You're in a desert under a strong sun, hot sun. Your head becomes like a hot teapot in about 15 minutes. So you throw away the helmet and you don't have the Panama. Not everybody has the Panama. So this is another problem. You will find out in the desert, as we have found out in Afghanistan, that sunstroke is the worst enemy, even worse than Iraqi soldiers, probably. It will knock out probably 10% or up to 12% of the units. The problem of water. It's easy to supply units with water when they are simply stationed there, but it'll be pretty difficult to do it during the war. Now, one canteen is not enough. Two canteen is not enough. So soldiers, it will be a big problem. Maps in a desert, they don't work because there's no marks. A lot of units will be lost and won't be able to identify themselves. Aviation will sometimes drop bombs and bomb their own American units because sometimes it's very hard to detect who is the enemy and who is your unit.
Did you find that a lot of Soviet soldiers experienced extreme disorientation because they were so unused to the desert climate?
I think in a way, yes. Besides, you see, a person becomes very weak in a desert in about 2 weeks or 4 weeks in a month because he sweats a lot. And with sweat, a lot of minerals and salts, important salts, leave human body. And they are very important for the body. And it took Soviet military doctors to invent, you know, special salt tablets. It took him 5 years probably to invent them and put them into the canteens, into the water, to compensate the losses of these important salts and minerals. So these kind of things, you see, these kind of things will play a very important role. Right now, you might think of them as not important, but then during war, they will play a very, very important role. And a lot of other things. Uniform is not very good. 50% of it is nylon in a desert. Nylon is not very good. So you will see all this.
Did the Soviet Army have any problems with sand getting into the arms? You know, getting into guns
oh,
and tanks and so on.
Oh, this is a serious problem. Yes, this is a very serious problem. You see, when M16 is a very good weapon, but if there's sand in it, it won't fire the way it should fire. From this point of view, AK Kalashnikov, that the main weapon the Soviet soldiers have, is a little bit better, because even if it's dirty, even if it's all in mud, it still can fire well enough. M16, from this point of view, it's got to be clean. And unfortunately, you cannot guarantee that in the desert. The same thing will happen with the soldier's eyes. We came into Afghanistan not thinking that we should give to every single soldier sunglasses to protect their eyes. You see, sun is very heavy there, very strong. And there is irritation of eyes immediately because of the sun and because of the sand. Sand is everywhere. Sand is in the air. And your eyes are red after 2 days you're in the desert, especially during war, where, you know, you're not in your camp every day. You're sometimes in a march for a few days, and things are extremely, extremely difficult during war. So America will experience all that very, very soon. Although I hope it will avoid it. I hope American military did think about all these things beforehand.
Now, one of the things you report in your
Terry, I wanted to add something. Sometimes the enemy will play serious tricks on you. And, for example, I remember in Afghanistan we were following a unit of the rebels, and we were probably 500 meters were between us and the rebels. And suddenly the rebel unit disappeared, and we just couldn't find it. The helicopters were trying to find them. They disappeared. What happened is each rebel lay down on the desert, and there was a heavy, very heavy wind, and in about 3 minutes they were all covered with sand. You couldn't see them. They had straws in their mouths that they could breathe, but you couldn't see them. Things like that you will find they will use things like that in a desert war.
My guest is Soviet journalist Artyom Borovik, and he covered the Soviet war in Afghanistan for the Soviet journal Ogonyuk, and he now co-anchors a weekly TV news show in the Soviet Union and is the editor of a magazine called Top Secret. He also reports for Nightline here in the United States, and he's written a book on covering the Soviet war in Afghanistan called The Hidden War. How do you think the long war the Soviets fought in Afghanistan is now affecting popular opinion about a possible war in the Gulf?
Well, you see, the war in Afghanistan for us was our Vietnam. And we had this Afghan syndrome right after the war. And I think it's very hard for you, Terry, to imagine America sending its troops to the Gulf in 1974 or 1975. Would you agree with that? The same thing happening in the Soviet Union. There's a very strong popular idea that we should not send our boys abroad. As a matter of fact, our boys are now fighting inside the Soviet Union. They are in Azerbaijan, they are in Armenia, they are in the Baltics right now. The war is going on full scale inside the Soviet Union. The nation is not ready to fight a war, another war, in the East or anywhere abroad. And this will probably be this way for the next few years. The conservative press and the conservatives are against Gorbachev supporting the coalition. The military, Soviet military, traditionally see Iraq as their ally rather than Kuwait. Besides, we have a lot of Muslims inside the Soviet Union. I'm talking about Azerbaijanis. I'm talking about all those Central Asian republics that we have, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzia and others. They're all Muslims, more than 20% of the Soviet population, and they all are supporting Saddam Hussein. Now, they are in favor of him. And now imagine the Soviet Union falls apart tomorrow. What will these republics do? Will they support the coalition or they will support Saddam Hussein? I'm afraid they will support Saddam Hussein. So the situation is very, very complicated. It's very difficult inside the Soviet Union. And I've seen a lot of... I'm an anchor for a TV program called Vzhlyad, translated Point of View, which is the Soviet version of American 60 Minutes. And I have interviewed people in Uzbekistan, the Muslims, and they are, at least 10 of them were ready to go and fight on the side of Saddam Hussein. Nobody of them wanted to join the coalition.
So you think that the Soviet Union is too busy being at war with itself to really fight a war outside?
Right now, yes. Soviet Union is too busy with the situation, preoccupied with the situation inside. The Gulf does not occupy an important place on the front pages of Soviet newspapers. When there's a deficit of bread, deficit of meat, deficit of everything, shortages, lines in the stores, people are more preoccupied with what's going on in their own home rather than what's going on in the Gulf, as long as Soviet forces and Russian boys are not there.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more.
Okay,
my guest is Soviet journalist Artyom Borovik. And he covered the war in Afghanistan for the Soviet journal Oganyuk. He also co-anchors a weekly TV news show in the Soviet Union and is the editor of a magazine called Top Secret. His new book is about covering the Soviet war in Afghanistan. It's called The Hidden War. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Soviet journalist Artyom Borovik is my guest. Do you think that any of the freedoms that journalists in the Soviet Union won under Glasnost are in jeopardy now?
I think that the empire is now striking back. Bureaucrats, the party, communists, the military, they have lost almost everything, and now they're fighting back. They're trying to, again, take control over the press, over television. And I would say that it's much easier for them to control television because the television is still under government control and is state-owned. A lot of newspapers, for example, Oganyok, are independent, but the television is still controlled by the government. If the authorities want to destroy Soviet parliament, they don't have to destroy the parliament itself. They should stop TV transmission of the debates in the parliament. And this is equal to killing the parliament because the Soviet public won't know what's going on there. What are the people talking about? What are the senators and congressmen talking about? My TV show was closed on the eve of the new year, because we invited the foreign minister Shevardnadze after his resignation to our studio and wanted to make a big interview with him. The next program was also closed. So I must tell you that the fight continues, and the one who thinks that Perestroika has won and there's freedom of press forever in the Soviet Union, he makes a mistake. Soviet journalists have to fight for what they have achieved, for their freedom every day with their every article. And especially Soviet journalists who were covering the war in Afghanistan experienced that. This is why the war in Afghanistan for a lot of Soviets is still a hidden war. A lot of people don't know the truth about this war. This is why I called my book The Hidden War. Now the situation has changed. Now, from the Baltics, for example, Soviet reporters give good information, truthful information. But again, it's not guaranteed that it will last. This process might be stopped any minute and or any second. Everything is not stable there.
When you were covering the Soviet war in Afghanistan, what was the official Soviet journalism like?
Well, if you thumb through, if you take a look at the newspapers and the magazines of the early 80s, the war started in 1979 in December, you would get an opinion that Soviets were guarding caravans, that they were serving only as advisors, that they were building schools and kindergartens, as if they were not participating in heavy fighting. It insulted even the soldiers themselves who returned from Afghanistan injured and with medals, and the people in buses and metro and the subways would ask, why did you put the medals on? You didn't deserve them. You were having nice time there in Afghanistan. The people knew nothing about the war in Afghanistan. This is what differs Afghanistan from the war America had in Vietnam, which was called even a war in the dining room, when, as you remember, Walter Cronkite and all other American reporters, Dan Rather, Ted Koppel, and others reported from Afghanistan, reported from Vietnam, giving America a very truthful information about what was going on, about the casualties and everything. Gorbachev risked to tell the Soviet public how many people we've lost in Afghanistan only after the war was over. And it ended February the 15th, 1989. So during the war, we were not able to inform the Soviet public about what was going there, about our boys dying there. And this is why Soviet journalists were not able to create an anti-war movement in the Soviet Union that would pressure the government, that would make the government stop the war in Afghanistan. The nation still knows very little about the war in Afghanistan. The story about this war is to be told to the Soviet public.
What are some of the things that you feel you were able to tell in your reporting that wasn't being told?
You see, for the first time I came to Afghanistan in 1986, and my work there as a war correspondent coincided with the beginning of Gorbachev's spring of glasnost, of outspokenness. And I've been able to tell much more than my predecessors, than the previous generation who was working in Afghanistan as war correspondents. Those guys sometimes thought, why should I go to a battle, to combat, to participate with the soldiers and see all that, risk my life, if back there in Moscow my editor won't publish it? I had an agreement with my editor-in-chief of my magazine that he will publish 100% of what I see. And he really did. And I think my magazine gave much more truthful information about the war. And although even in 1989, when I was reporting about the final days of the war, I had serious problems with Soviet censorship.
I've always heard that people in the Soviet Union have been very wary about speaking openly to the press. I'm wondering, when you were in Afghanistan, how open the soldiers were with you, and if they trusted you, if they thought maybe you were an agent of some sort, or that by speaking to you, they or their families could be hurt?
In the beginning, in 1986, they did not trust me. They did not respect me because they did not respect journalists who were writing lies from Afghanistan. Then they thought that I am probably another one of those journalists who will write romantic stuff from Afghanistan and lie to the public about them. And I had to be with them, go with them into combat to prove that I can go through the same difficulties and hardships as they did. And only then they would start talking. When Oganyok in those days, in 1987, was not the famous Oganyok of today. When I came in 1989 as a correspondent of Oganyok, the military treated me as if I was the enemy and not the rebels. And it was very hard for me to speak to the soldiers without being accompanied by some political officer. We have such a something like public affairs officer who followed me all the time, and certainly soldiers were afraid to speak, but I managed to get away from the control of the political officers and was lost in the midst of the war, and then is when real journalism started. This is when I could see and hear the truth.
So the officers distrusted you, but the soldiers trusted you more.
Yes, it depends what officers, but generally the staff in Kabul, the commanders, they kind of thought that I cannot be trusted. They thought that I'm sort of a, you know, provocative journalist that will, you know, cause trouble for them, write about things they wouldn't like the public to know. But the soldiers wanted to tell me all that because they wanted the nation to know what about all those terrible things that we were doing in Afghanistan and about the low morale in the army and so on.
When Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze resigned, he said that he thought the Soviet Union was moving toward a dictatorship. Do you think that that's an overstatement or do you agree?
Well, I think that the Soviet Union is moving towards a more conservative path, more right path. At the same time, this statement made by Mr. Shevardnadze made a lot of people smile because Mr. Shevardnadze himself, 5 years ago, was a dictator and he was had an enormous amount of power. He was the first secretary of the Communist Party of Georgia. Believe me, he had all the power he needed. Not every king has had such a power as Mr. Shevardnadze did. But this man played a very important role in the years of perestroika. And I think that he really is a strong supporter of the ideas of perestroika now. And I'm afraid that the country is moving towards right, towards conservatism. And this is very dangerous. Unfortunately, you see, in the eyes of the millions, the ideas of perestroika, the ideas of democracy, of liberty, are associated in the people's minds with chaos, with food deficit, with shortages of everything, with lines in the streets and in the stores, with the crime in the streets, with national unrest, with war that is going on in Armenia, in Moldavia, in other republics, now probably in the Baltics. So a lot of people think better that it's better to have bread and order than to have free press, freedom and democracy. And as Benjamin Franklin said one day, I don't remember the very phrase, but I am sure that the essence is right. He said that if a nation that is ready to exchange freedom for bread and order in the final end does not deserve democracy, freedom, and bread and order.
My guest has been Soviet journalist Artyom Borovik. His book on the Soviet war in Afghanistan is called The Hidden War. Borovik can occasionally be seen reporting for Nightline. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The hero in Madison Smart Bell's new novel has insomnia. His view of the world is altered by his own sleeplessness. Coming up, Madison Smart Bell tells us how his insomnia shaped his writing. Also, rock historian Ed Ward turns the clock back 10 years with a profile of 1981. And book critic John Leonard reviews John le Carré's new spy novel, The Secret Pilgrim. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar is in Amman tonight on his way to see Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. President Bush has described the Secretary General's mission as having a glimmer of hope. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports from Amman.
UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar said tonight that he would describe himself as neither an optimist nor a pessimist about his mission to Baghdad, but he said he was hopeful. He said that he and President Saddam Hussein would have a useful talk and that he will propose ways and means by which we might get out of this, quote, unfortunate situation. Perez de Cuellar wouldn't comment on a European community plan introduced today in Geneva, which calls for a UN peacekeeping force in Kuwait if Iraq withdraws from it unconditionally. Perez de Cuellar did say that if such a plan were implemented, he'd consult the governments involved. But it's unlikely that Baghdad would accept something like that. Today, Saddam Hussein told a group of Islamic ministers meeting in Baghdad that he was prepared for a war, a holy jihad, and that Iraq would win. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
And the White House said this evening that the Soviet Union is now pursuing new diplomatic avenues in hopes of resolving the Persian Gulf crisis. However, presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater cautioned, "We don't want to unnecessarily get our hopes up." Soviet leader Gorbachev telephoned the president this morning, and Fitzwater says the Soviet ambassador to Washington met twice today with Mr. Bush. On Capitol Hill, both the House and Senate are moving closer to granting the president the authority to commit American troops to battle. In the House, debate is expected to continue late tonight, with a vote scheduled sometime tomorrow. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports a resolution supporting the war option is expected to pass.
Quoting Churchill, St. Augustine, Robert Kennedy, Theodore Roosevelt, and even Adolf Hitler, members of the House expressed their views on whether or not the United States should go to war. Although the resolution which gives the president the authority to move troops into battle is not a formal declaration of war, members who oppose it say it might as well be. Democrats who favor the continued use of sanctions instead say it's too soon to sacrifice American lives. James Traficant of Ohio.
Now, if all the so-called experts around here are correct that are predicting 1,000 dead Americans, then why did the Pentagon recently order 16,000 human remain pouches?
The House is likely to give the president what he's asked for, the authority to use force, although the leaders of House Democrats support continuing sanctions and holding back on granting the war option until the last possible moment. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 3 points to close at 2,501.49 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, what happens to spies after the Cold War? John Leonard reviews John le Carré's new novel, The Secret Pilgrim. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward generally has at least a 10-year distance on the music he discusses on our show. So Ed's been picking through 1981.
It's funny, but when I mentioned to several friends that I was about to do a piece on the music of 1981, their faces all got these rapturous expressions. "That's going to be a good one," one of them said. And now, having hit the books, read the charts, and checked out copyright dates on records, I know what they were thinking. 1981 was high tide for the new wave. It was the year the revolution in popular music that had been building for 5 years was going to sweep away the old and bring in the new. Certainly the signs were there. Black music, for instance, hadn't been this exciting in years.
You see, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Bad Bad Betty told me every cut side. DJ Spin. is cool, Francois, c'est pas la chaîne adieu.
He say one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Previously, rap had had to laboriously recreate a DJ's scratching techniques with live instruments, but Grandmaster Flash showed how it could be done in the studio with the adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, thereby opening the door to contemporary rap recording. Out of nowhere, Warner Brothers, a label with a lousy reputation in black music, launched a third album by a soul singer from Minneapolis that had a strange sticker on its cover. Programmers, it read, audition prior to airing. Good idea.
You were mine, I gave you all of my money, time after time. You done me wrong, it's just like a train. You let all my friends come over and meet, and you were so strange. You didn't have the decency to change the sheet. Oh girl, when you were
Of course, Prince's album was called Dirty Mind, so that in itself was a warning. And hot on its heels came a record from Motown by Rick James, a former bandmate of Neil Young.
She's a very kinky girl, the kind you don't take home to mother. She will never let your spirits down once you get her off the street. Oh, girl. She likes the boys in the band. She says that I'm her all-time favorite.
The unusual thing about both Prince and Rick James is that their records were bestsellers without having hit singles. The trends were being set in rock dance clubs, not discos, and on college radio stations, which were emerging as a major source of airplay for unusual music. Since most other American rock music was either the same old stuff or very poppy new wave, the majority of the non-black music in these clubs and on these stations was British. Duran Duran was a good example of the British post-punk dance music that was selling up a storm over there. Clothes horses of both sexes celebrated London's new affluence under Margaret Thatcher's rule at clubs like Cabaret Futura and the Club for Heroes. Perhaps tellingly, the bands these folks liked, like Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet, tended to dress like bank tellers. Naturally, there was a reaction to this, too. Guitar-centered bands like U2, the Psychedelic Furs, and such Liverpool-based bands as Wah and Echo and the Bunnymen became great U.S. favorites because of their more traditional sound and because of college radio airplay. If 1981 was a terribly anglophilic year, I mean, it could even be said that Prince's new synth-heavy sound derived from bands like Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, it was because the best we could chart at home was The Cars, Hall & Oates, Air Supply, Christopher Cross, and A Taste of Honey. Naturally, there was a reaction to that going on, too.
Dallas, Coward, ride the cold. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. They distort what we say. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Try and stop what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they
In Southern California, a generation of bands arose that considered the L.A. punk scene soft and old, led by Black Flag and the Minutemen, who were so named because their songs rarely exceeded 60 seconds in length. 1981 also saw the rise of the Go-Go's, and songs like Blondie's The Tide Is High were bearable. And there was a buzz on about this new band from Georgia, R.E.M. Yeah, things were on the move.
That's R.E.M. Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. And he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Adrian Strother can't sleep. Strother is the protagonist in Madison Smart Bell's new novel, Dr. Sleep. Strother is a hypnotherapist and ex-junkie living and working in London. The deeper he goes into sleeplessness, the more psychotic he gets. He's prone to megalomania anyway. In a review of Dr. Sleep in the New York Times, Elizabeth Tallant wrote, "Bell renders the marginal, the underground, the twisted or seedy with quirky attentiveness. He catches the poignant in the freakish." Dr. Sleep is Bell's sixth novel. I asked Bell to read from the opening paragraph of Dr. Sleep.
O Lord, my God, creator of the universe, once again you caused me to remain awake the whole night through. Toward dawn, I think I managed to forget myself a little, but you couldn't really have called it sleep. More like floating from layer to layer of not sleeping, from shade to shade of white, if there was any such distinction.
Do you have problems with insomnia yourself, and does that have anything to do with your new novel?
I do occasionally. It used to be a lot worse. I now occasionally have what I call an insomnia jag of maybe 3 days of a lot of trouble sleeping, and then it will stop.
Well, that's about the length of time that elapses in your book.
You're given to believe. The novel takes 3 days to happen, and 3 nights the narrator doesn't sleep. But you are sort of given to believe in the beginning that he's been up a lot longer than that before he starts talking.
What kind of state does a typical insomnia jag leave you in?
Well, it makes it very difficult to function well in waking life. I mean, the typical problem is you. When you're supposed to be sleeping, you're really vividly awake, and when you're not supposed to be sleeping, you're very sleepy, and you feel like you would be sleeping, you know, this very minute if only you weren't so busy, you know, trying to incompetently do your tasks that you can't do very well.
Why was this a state you wanted to capture in a novel?
Well, I suppose I like the idea of the increasing tension of a consciousness that never rests. It builds up over a period of time, and... You know, an unsleeping consciousness is kind of an interesting thing. I mean, if you didn't experience it, you might think it was desirable.
You've described yourself as being interested in extreme mental states. Is that due to experimentation you've taken yourself or extremes that you've experienced?
Inadvertently, mostly. Yes, well, Flannery O'Connor has an idea that which I have always thought was true, that when the personality is stretched to the breaking point, it reveals itself more plainly. I think that's a very interesting idea, to the extent to which it is absolutely true, I wonder, but it's dramatically effective.
So how have you stretched your own over the years?
Sort of a general question. I've tried probably most of the usual ways. Vice, danger, foolhardiness, insomnia.
You've made your main character a hypnotherapist. Was that another form of altered consciousness that you wanted to explore in the book, hypnosis?
Yes, I went to a hypnotist for the first time maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I suppose I didn't know very much about hypnosis then, and I thought it was a very interesting state to be in, and in many ways rather enviable. The state of being in hypnosis is extremely pleasant. It is a very relaxed state. You get some of the benefits that people get from things like transcendental meditation. You get some of the benefits that people get from drugs without the consequences, by and large.
What sent you into hypnosis?
Stress. A kind of complex of minor problems that had to do, insomnia was probably the worst, and other little stress-related tics that I wanted to get rid of. As a therapy, hypnosis has been most successful, or anyway, that's the rep in handling minor problems like small-time phobias, small-time stress problems, and small-time addictions like cigarette smoking. Most people who are strictly hypnotists and not also analysts or psychiatrists of some kind or other will tend to stay away from deep psychotic problems. This also becomes an issue in the novel, where you have one of these guys who has no medical degree, has no official psychiatric training, dealing with people who are drastically sick.
Split personality, drug addict.
Multiple personality, I think, which is different.
Right, yeah.
Different from schizophrenia, although often confused.
Most of your fiction is very urban. This novel, for instance, is pretty urban, and you have... you have thugs and drug addicts and street punks and so on. You grew up on a farm in Tennessee. From there, I think you went to Princeton to go to college and then ended up in New York City or on the outskirts of New York City. So what were your first encounters with city life like?
Well, very intimidating, I think. I began to go to New York when I was a college student, and I would always be lost and confused and somewhat afraid because I knew that I was visibly incompetent to handle the situation. I sort of resented that. It's one of the reasons I wanted to go back and live there, because I didn't like the idea of being defeated by, you know, and frightened away. So I went back and stayed for 7 years until I knew it really very well and even became a little tired of it. But there's something very attractive to me all along about perpetual motion, a hive of activity, which is, of course, unsleeping.
Well, I think part of that activity, from what I know about you, is the activity of roaches that were in your apartment. It sounds like your early years, anyways, in the city were spent in cheap apartments. I think you were involved with drugs at the time. It sounds like, you know, the underside of the city. Though nearly every place in New York has,
I wasn't ever very deeply involved in drugs because I couldn't afford it. I moved to New York straight out of college, and I didn't get a job. It was sort of the underside or the flip side of the coin, in which the Ivy League English major goes in and gets an entry level job in publishing. I wanted to go there and not do that, and live by doing pickup work or somehow. And so I naturally ended up in the ghetto. And sadly, I think it's no longer possible to do that with any remote degree of safety, since I lived there during the time that I lived there, the expense of being in the city, even in the most marginal way, tripled at least. And the dangers went up. But for me at that time, for the first 3 or 4 years, it was an acceptable level of risk.
You started writing and getting published when you were pretty young, when you were in your 20s.
I think I was 25 when my first book came out.
Were you ever seen by literary critics as part of a group of younger writers?
You know, no, I missed that. I missed that completely. And it used to irritate me in the beginning that I wasn't getting any sort of promotional points for being a prodigy. But 5 years later, around the time I turned 30, and the media turned on all their young wunderkind writers and started calling them the Brat Pack and kicking them around, I realized I'd been extremely lucky to have been handled as an adult all along, which I think in a way I was. So I didn't get no candy, but then I escaped the backlash also, and I think that was good.
When you were younger, you were able to flirt with different kinds of dangers, mental states, stuff like that. Now that you're in your 30s, do you still find yourself doing that, flirting with danger, or, you know, with altered perception, or is it all
I really, I tell you what, I try not to do anything anymore that has real risk to it, because it's not just me anymore. I'm married now. My wife is expecting a baby. I don't feel, you know, freedom to take risks with my life just for fun, even if they're small, that I did before, and I can't say I particularly miss it. The one thing that keeps that going for me a little bit is martial arts, which I do every day.
How does that help you?
Well, it's a stylized risk situation. You go in and you do a lot of strenuous physical activity and you fight, but you're not going to get killed. But symbolically, it's as if you might.
Do you worry about running out of material if you remove yourself from that kind of risky situation that you used to thrive on?
Not really. I think the writer who writes only about his own sensibility is at risk of running out, I think. But I've never felt that I was that kind of writer. I'm interested in other people.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, sure. My pleasure.
Medicine Smart Bell's new novel is Dr. Sleep. Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on today's debate in Congress?
Well, we'll have news of the debates in both houses of Congress on President Bush's policy in the Gulf. In the House of Representatives, where there's a very strong Democratic margin, the president seems to have a pretty strong majority willing to pass a resolution, much like the resolution of the U.N. Security Council on the use of force. But in the Senate, where the Democrats also have a majority, it seems to be much, much closer. We'll be hearing about that. Also, a talk with an Israeli cabinet minister who insists that Israel will not stage any preemptive strike against Iraq, and news of the very serious crackdown in Lithuania today by Soviet forces.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John le Carré's last novel, The Russia House, which is now also a movie, was called the first spy novel in the age of glasnost. In his new novel, The Secret Pilgrim, Le Carré explores the spiritual questions an ex-spy might face. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
What will the spies do now that the Cold War is over? George Smiley, looking into his balloon glass for brandy and wisdom, tells a graduating class of eager beavers, "It's not only our minds we're going to have to reconstruct either. It's the overmighty modern state we've built for ourselves as a bastion against something that isn't there anymore. We've given up far too many freedoms in order to be free. Now we've got to take them back." Just how a brand new bunch of spies is going to do this, Smiley doesn't say. He has spent the evening with them at the invitation of their teacher, his old friend and former pupil, Ned, who was put out to pasture by the circus after the disaster described in John le Carré's previous novel, The Russia House. Ned listens to Smiley, but he dreams of himself and the decades he's devoted to the service of his country in London, Warsaw, Hamburg, Beersheba, and Bangkok. Ned's flashbacks at first seem merely anecdotal, an amateur mistake that blows a network, a mistaken identity that ruins a life, loneliness and madness, love gone wrong. But as Ned sinks deeper through the geologic layers of his deceptions, a spy on himself in the house of his memory, the stories get longer and darker. Instead of rock, he finds jungle rot, quicksand, and vacuum. Who was the enemy who had cost him so many friends and so much of his life, overt and covert? A civil servant Ned investigates, under suspicion because he used to go to Covent Garden with a Soviet spy, tells him this: "I lived the wrong life, that's all. You don't know till it's too late, though, do you? You think you're one person, you turn out to be another. Same as opera." Later on, the evil empire is voted out of power in Eastern Europe by its own citizens, on its own mean streets. But new enemies turn up in England itself. A Thatcherite arms merchant, Sir Anthony Joyston Bradshaw, refuses Ned's request to stop destabilizing the Middle East. Sir Anthony boasts of the cellars of his country house, where there are rusty iron rings that used to hold the original owner's slaves. "Think there aren't any slaves today?" Sir Anthony demands of Ned. "Think capital doesn't depend on slaves? Jesus Christ, what kind of shop do you run?" What kind indeed? Whatever became of Ned's passion and faith? A renegade agent, fresh from torture in Cambodia, tells him this: "Once you have embarked upon the impossible concept of God, you will know that real love permits no rejection. Perhaps that is something only a sinner can properly understand. Only a sinner knows the scale of God's forgiveness." Ned is entitled to wonder whether he's in a novel by John le Carré or Graham Greene, not to mention Joseph Conrad, who is the writer le Carré would really like to be. If all spies are sinners, who is God? For all its chat about opera, The Secret Pilgrim is really an oratorio. That is, the text on which the chorus and the orchestra remark has a religious theme. For all that we meet again the old rogues' gallery of double agents, watchers, emigres, and moles, the luckless Hungarian Joes and the crazy Oxford Dons, the Esterhazes and the cool Bill Haydens, Ned's is a pilgrim's progress, past all dragons, fighting off what Smiley calls the angels and whores of ideology, towards some lost faith. What we have is Le Carré's best novel since The Honorable Schoolboy, and this time the reluctant hero doesn't die from his ambivalence.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Secret Pilgrim by John le Carré. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the head of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee about the FBI's current investigation of Arab American business and political leaders. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.